Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that has to ask, really? We got to Atomic Blonde? I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigeiser. Now, Dave, you may notice that I sound a little different tonight.
Really? Why is that?
Well, first off, I'm actually recording at a slightly higher elevation, because yesterday, me and my father spent 7 hours building a new bed. It was a lovely gift, though. Thanks, Mom and Dad. The other thing you will notice is that I probably sound a little bedraggled, because I spent 7 hours building a bed with my father yesterday. So apologies in advance if I have a hard time staying focused, but that's also directly attributable to the film we watched this week. But before we get into that, Dave, who are we and what are we doing with your time and your ears?
Well, this is indeed Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every episode, Andrew and I, and possibly assorted guests on some episodes, take a look at a film, dissect it, look at it, find all the nuance and substance that we can pull out of it. That will not be happening this week. But in the one thing that must happen each and every episode is that the film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed the preceding episode.
There's the accent again. If this is your first episode, Dave always puts on a weird accent when he says the preceding film.
Yes, yes. So from the preceding episode, Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Believe it or not, that actually gave me enough time to remember. Last week, we were looking at the... Now I can't remember what year it was, but the film Sea of Love. The 1989 Sea of Love. Directed by some guy, and featuring a lot of very interesting and oddly humorous reversals of both noir and erotic cinema. Best of all, it didn't star Michael Douglas. However, one of the cast members was our go-to standby, John Goodman, who now is firmly ahead of Peter Falk and Mako and Neil Young as all-time appearance leader. Instead, we have decided to follow John Goodman largely out of necessity to his acting role in 2017's David Leitch-directed Atomic Blonde, featuring a script by that Kurt Johnstad, featuring an actually pretty killer soundtrack by Tyler Bates, and a cast featuring Charlize Theron, John Goodman, James McAvoy, Sophia Boutella, Bill Skarsgård pre-clown, and Toby Jones.
That's right. So, yes, I mean, all I will say is that, look, if you're with us this week, we get to some better stuff coming up. Trust me, this really was an episode built out of necessity, as painful as it is to say.
We're playing the long game on this one. But you know what the opposite of long is, Dave?
What's that?
Short. And in a way to keep things short, Dave, some people might not know what Atomic Blonde is about. So why don't you give us the rundown.
Atomic Blonde is the 2017 end of Cold War action film from director David Leitch and producer Charlize Theron. Adapted from the 2012 graphic novel The Coldest City, the film stars Theron as an MI6 agent tasked with a mission to recover a vital list in Berlin in the days leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall. A modest box office hit, Atomic Blonde was met with mixed reviews from critics. Despite this, a potential sequel to the film has been considered. Coming up after Filmstrips, a rebroadcast of the 1990 pilot film for the proposed television series adaptation of Do the Right Thing, written, produced, directed, and starring Alan Alda, with Alfonso Ribeiro in the role of Mookie.
So, Atomic Blonde.
Yep.
Okay. Recently, I think anyone who is going to listen to a film podcast on the internet, with a website you can check out at filmstripspodcast.home.blog, where you can get our full episode archive, as well as our handy listener's guide and links to our friends. I think anybody who uses the internet and talks about movies is aware of the recent furor over Martin Scorsese. Right?
Yes, I think that's safe to say.
And, I mean, the gist of it, I didn't wade too much into it because, you know, first everyone's like, I think The Irishman promotes violence. And I'm like, whatever. And then it's, I think Martin Scorsese is out of touch. And it's whatever. And then, I think superhero films are just a thrill ride. And then I get my back up. No, I'm still just like, whatever. Yeah. But, yeah, so recently Martin Scorsese came out and was fairly dismissive against superhero films. Largely the Marvel ones, was it directed about?
It was. I mean, really, he was targeting the genre overall, but Marvel in particular, because as ever, they've become because of their success, they've now become sort of the poster boy for we got to take him down a peg. Because Sure, why not?
I mean, what if post-structuralism was around in the early days of Walt Disney? You know, that would be so amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, effectively, to boil it down for those who didn't wade into it, yes, Scorsese was asked about it because basically news websites needed clickbait articles to enrage people so that they got angry. And it came down to Martin Scorsese giving the answer you would kind of expect, which is he doesn't really care for the genre. And he basically said that they're like theme parks at the end of the day, where it's all about sensation over any sort of meaningful storylines. And then, you know, somebody decided to ask Francis Ford Coppola, who, okay, went even further than Scorsese. And
because I think you've brought up previously, I'm not sure if it was on the show or not, but you've previously brought up, I think, the very good point that all these directors who are now decrying modern cinema when financially it's probably more successful than any of their films ever were, like, that's what the industry is now. And they can decry the studios for no longer recognizing, like, the film brats or the auteur maverick style of filmmaking and instead becoming corporatized. But that the whole reason the industry shifted was largely because of these guys' own responsibility. And you sort of get back to that point where it's like, well, if this was the best cinema ever was, why did it stop being that? You know? And there are very clear reasons. Yeah. Like, I think if letting Roman Polanski and Robert Evans, the late Robert Evans and others, more or less have free rein with other people's money and in some cases other people's bodies and livelihood, like, if doing that was so wonderful, how come the industry then changed course? It's like professional wrestlers who retire and then complain about successful acts these days. And it's like, no, wrestling is this. It's like, well, if that's the case, how come you weren't a bigger star? Like, if cinema artistically and financially is really about this this pioneer spirit, then how come those films haven't held up or made the same splash, right? There's a lot of reasons why it's different, but it's like, well, do we really expect them to wholeheartedly embrace what came after them?
Well, and here's the thing. I will say this before we move this more towards the Atomic Blood side of things. But the thing about it, for me, it always comes down to that even at the height of the Hollywood Renaissance, even at the height of the sort of freewheeling American cinema where it was challenging and, you know, bringing sort of moral ambiguity and political complexity to the mainstream, while, yes, there are the mega hits like The Godfather and The Conversation, the majority of this stuff bombed and was basically subsidized by the big commercial hits. So at the end of the day, you know, it is required.
Yes. So I guess that brings us to Atomic Blonde, though, because by all accounts, this film made somewhere near $100 million at the box office and was successful enough to generate at least some talk of a follow-up in that. Certainly, it's not doing gangbusters like a movie like Endgame did, but this feels like the kind of cinema that the descriptor of thrill ride cinema much more aptly applies to. I recently went to Canada's Wonderland, and this film very much felt like some of the roller coasters, because you wait a bit to see it, and then you spend, in this case, two interminable hours instead of, like, you know, two thrilling minutes, and then it's over, and then you go on and do something else. This is high-gloss cinema that is fundamentally empty.
Well, it's fundamentally empty, which, let's be clear here, isn't inherently a bad thing. I mean, let's be honest here. I think most of the films that people love of action cinema are not necessarily always of the highest quality out there. I mean, let's be honest. How many trashy 90s action films do we love? James, I'm looking specifically at you. We've got things like, okay, Sudden Death, Die Hard in a hockey rink. Not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it's fun. Or you have Virtuosity. Again, not a good movie, but it is Denzel Washington basically fighting a version of Russell Crowe who's effectively playing the Joker.
I think you can like virtuosity for ironic reasons, but then there are also films like Demolition Man, which I think are genuinely very well done films, if not necessarily great works of cinema. There's something to be said for a film knowing what it is and being that. And we've discussed it before that like part of the reason we love, or at least I love, films like Steven DeSouza's Street Fighter the movie is because it is a film that is so acutely aware of all that it ever can amount to, and it just plays into that fully.
Well, precisely. And
there is nothing like stoic or faux solemn about Street Fighter. Even when you get those moments of solemnity, it is done in such a deliberately over-the-top and outrageous way that it just becomes terrific. This is a film where I feel like it does the opposite, because it's high gloss, almost painstaking attention to detail, and none of it matters. Because there's no import, it's all just buried under solemnity and that icy coolness. It's like running your fingers over the surface of a photograph.
Well, and here's the thing about Atomic Blonde, which we already pointed out in the rundown, but bear with us. This is based off of a graphic novel, The Coldest City, by Anthony Johnston and illustrated by Sam Hart.
Yeah, sadly nothing to do with Anthony and the Johnsons, who at least have that one good record. Dave, you've read that book. I have not.
It's been a few years, about three, since I read it, but I remember when the Atomic Blonde was coming up, it's like, oh, it's based off this graphic novel I haven't read. Sounds interesting at the very least. A spy thriller set at the fall of the Berlin Wall. Why not?
Yeah. I remember the trailer. I knew nothing about it, but I at least it stuck out because I'm like, wow, visually, that looks like an interesting film.
Well, precisely. And let me put it to you this way, folks. When you read the graphic novel, it's fascinating because it is one of the most bland, unengaging graphic novels. Like, it's not awful or offensively bad, but it's really nothing more than a greatest hits of Cold War spy thrillers.
It's like what everybody thinks a John le Carré novel is going to be rather than what John le Carré novels are, which I don't mean as a negative because I love John le Carré.
Well, that's the thing. Like, there is something to be said for the spy tales that take a grounded approach where it's about basically the people who operate on the ground, and they're not James Bond. This is not spy fantasy in the same sense. These are the people who make choices based off information they have, who have to operate in a grounded, real-world way, and make their way through it.
Yeah, and like when The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is kind of like a watershed moment in that sort of the spy narrative, because I think it's 1963 it comes out, but that is very much like, nope, we are cogs in a much bigger machine that even we don't understand, and we are forced to make decisions that benefit our enemies and punish noble people because that's what's expedient.
Well, precisely. And unfortunately, when you look at the graphic novel, it really is, it aims to be one something along those lines, but really all you're getting is the riffs on standard spy tropes, and including, you know, double agents, leaks within the agency, and
secret documents hidden in a watch, and a guy with magic memory powers ripped straight from the 39 steps.
Well, to be fair, in that instance, I think that one was an invention for the film. But the point being that,
yeah, just like with Charlize Theron's character's bisexuality, apparently.
Well, we'll get there. The key thing here is that basically it's a dull graphic novel, but all it is a loose framework where not a lot happens. It's not an action piece. It's, again, it's a very dry, super dry basic spy thriller that lacks any actual thrills.
Yeah, but there's so many comics out there, and I mean, especially because the market plummeted, like, you have to pay $30 for a trade, right? At least one of the good ones. So I mean, if I'm dropping $30 on something, I want it to be better than middling. And the sad part is, like, I have a huge number of comics on my shelf where it's like 100 bullets, for instance, where it's like, well, it's good enough, I wouldn't make a movie out of this. And the only reason I bring that up, though, is because for a bit of production context for this film, apparently the real driving force behind getting it made was Charlize Theron, and apparently it's because she was absolutely enamored with this graphic novel.
And more to the point, she apparently had a copy of this graphic novel before it was released. Now, Andrew, what was the last time we took a look at a film based off a work that was really a part of a star's drive to see it happen because they happened to get a copy before anybody else out there?
Okay, that happened with Father Goose, but I feel like that happened again somewhere.
Yes, and that last time that happened in this instance, it was Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Oh, yeah. And we all know how well that turned out. Okay, so this one at least made money.
Yes, that's true. This one, yeah, it cost a more reasonable amount. And certainly...
And there's no one as unlikable as Chevy Chase in this film. So we're off to a good start.
Yeah, and let's be honest here. Charlize Theron is a very, actually, intelligent actor. In terms of the kinds of projects she does. Not everything is great. That's not what I'm trying to claim here, but...
She's had a broad career, but, I mean, there are definitely roles that she has had. Oh, let's think of some good ones. Certainly Monster, which she rightfully won the Oscar for.
Yeah.
What are some of the other big hits? Well, Mighty Joe Young.
Well, she's coming off of...
The Astronaut's Wife.
Yeah. Well, in this instance, she's coming off of Mad Max Fury Road, which, you know, which she received probably more acclaim than anybody else in that film, including star Tom Hardy.
Yeah, because you could understand her spoken dialogue.
Well, yes. Plus, she was also given spoken dialogue. He mostly had grunts.
Valid point.
But the...
Nice rocket jetski.
Like, did he forget to take the Bane mask off?
Apparently. The key thing here being that Tom Hardy aside, Theron, is an intelligent actor, and she is somebody who has strived to make better films for women actors in Hollywood, for the most part. And at least for nobody else than her own sake. And I will say this, if there is one element of Atomic Blonde that we're going to get into that's worthwhile, there are a couple points where I think some choices are made that it's a bit much to say are progressive, but are at least interesting, and I can guarantee Theron was probably behind most of them.
Well, it's kind of like that safe version of female empowerment, right? Like, I don't think anyone, you know, for all we critique it, I don't think that something like the Spice Girls and girl power being branded on, like, Chupa Chups lollipops, I don't think anyone seriously entertains that that's going to start, like, a worldwide revolution.
No.
It's a small step. It's a step that is heavily branded by corporate interests. Like, not to date this episode, but, I mean, yesterday was the wrestling event Crown Jewel in Saudi Arabia, and, as cynical as the whole thing is for a publicly traded wrestling federation that denies unionization and healthcare benefits to its employees and treats them like independent contractors and left them stranded in a foreign country, they still got to go in front of a major outdoor stadium, and two women came out, and even though they basically had to wear scuba gear to cover their bodies, they had the first ever women's wrestling match in Saudi Arabia. Both of them were visibly moved by that moment. And there are times where it's like, okay, well, even when you set aside all the cynicism and the monetization of things, there are moments that are created. I don't think this is a film that necessarily creates those moments.
Well, no. And like I said, whatever progress it makes is very small, and we'll get there once we start getting into the meat of the film proper.
Yeah, this is the Facebook-like of girl power.
The point here being that in this instance, when it comes to basically what this film's approach to adapting the graphic novel is, well, they hire people who, at least on page, seem like they might be, if not necessarily interesting choices, ones that might or at least make a degree of sense.
All right, who's the crew?
Okay, so on this one, we have Kurt Johnstad of the 300 movies and Act of Valor writing the screenplay. Not a great writer.
I don't know what the movie Act of Valor is.
Basically a military movie starring actual soldiers in at least some of the roles. That's all you need to know. Not good. Oh, point being, though,
I can't wait to not see that.
Yeah. The point being here, though, that, I mean, at least he's coming from something of an action background, and particularly writing stylized movies, which is a good thing when you have, as your director, David Leitch, who, at this point, was coming off of the co-directing, and I'm not sure whether he received credit on it, but the first John Wick film.
Yeah, and that's what I understand, that apparently he got almost, like, poached off of that.
To some degree, and again, I mean, he comes onto this one bringing that pedigree with him, while his co-director on the first John Wick film would go on to helm the next two entries in that series. But this is somebody who's gone on to do Deadpool 2, which, whether you love it or hate it, you know, very successful film, and I think works for what it is. And again, has now done the Fast and the Furious Hobbs and Shaw film, which I haven't seen it. I'm not a Fast and the Furious fan, really, so I'm not seeking it out. But this is somebody who's at least, you know, earned a place in the Hollywood mainstream.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the John Wick films, I think, kind of are the template that this film tries to adhere to. Because, I mean, well, with some crucial differences. Because I do not mean to be an expert on all things John Wick, but they end up being incredibly stylized yet relatively inexpensive action films that end up being commercial and critical hits. Maybe not like all-time record setters, but safe investments for studios, almost.
Well, it's the thing. It's a series that, as it's gone on, has its critical reputation's increased, its success has increased, and it's kept its budgets relatively modest by comparison to most action cinema produced at the big studio level.
Yeah, and like, there's a section of culture where John Wick as a character, like, that means something to them in ways that, say, Jet Li from Romeo Must Die never did.
Well, precisely. I mean, John Wick is probably our closest equivalent to sort of a John McClane figure for this generation, where, yeah, that's your sort of definition of an action hero right now, is your sort of go-to.
And the guy who defined action cinema as Neo a decade earlier.
Well, exactly. But the key thing here is that here's the fundamental difference. Why both are highly stylized films. The John Wick movies take place in a sort of unique fantasy land that starts off with a very basic premise. Man's dog is killed at one point. Turns out man who owned dog is a former hitman who decides to go out and get revenge. And kind of the joy of those movies is watching how this very simple beginning keeps spiraling out into this bizarro, weird mythology universe that of ever increasing repercussions, where it just gets weirder and wilder, and some people don't like it. If you're like me, you're kind of on board, but it's an absurdist fantasy to some, openly with, you know, again, and hey, it appeals to dog lovers anywhere, everywhere. The point being here that, okay, that's fine. That makes sense. Nobody goes into a John Wick movie expecting a nuanced, complicated film. It just doesn't happen.
Right. Which, I think that is the key departure from that template that Atomic Blonde makes. Because it wants to be a very stylish and hip take on the ambiguity and iciness and, like, personal struggles that one faces when they're dealing with espionage. And it wants to be so slick. And it's set in Berlin, right before the wall came down. It's all about the Cold War. But it's adopting those things as visual icons and, like, storytelling gimmicks while having absolutely no narrative, thematic, or political engagement with those objects that it's depicting.
Well, and this, yeah, is the main thing. John Wick is not a film about history.
And it's not a film that pretends it has anything to say about history, either. Whereas this film, that's not to say it's pretending that it has something to say, but it's very curious, then, that you would set it where it is and when it is, if you're not going to deal with that.
Well, and that's the thing. And if anybody would like to go back into our back catalog and listen to any episode prior to listening to this one, I highly recommend checking out our Wings of Desire one. Because Wings of Desire is a film made in Berlin prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Immediately prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that film is by Wim Wenders, and it is all about the meaning of that wall and what Berlin is in 1987.
And I mean, not for nothing, that episode also is when you and I talked about the history of post-war Germany. So we're not going to rehash that here. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. The point being there is that, yeah, that is a loaded space in which to set it there, in which to set a film. And particularly the actual moment where the Berlin Wall falls is major history. One of the key defining moments of the late 20th century in terms of global geopolitics. Because, yeah.
And certainly one of the most visually arresting images in news footage of the last century as well.
Well, precisely. And again, I mean, I will say this. I mean, the part of the thing is that once the wall fell, and then a couple of years later, the Cold War, the Cold War was effectively done at that point, but the absolute dissolution of the Soviet Union in 91 really sort of, you know, cements the fact that, yeah, the Cold War era is over. And that was such a defining conflict for everybody. And it's no shock that in the, after the Cold War ends, so much of spy fiction, which had been defined by the Cold War, suddenly finds itself struggling with, well, what are we going to do now? In the case of Hunt for Red October, you had a film that decided, well, let's ignore history for a moment and just set it back during the Cold War so we don't necessarily have to address things.
Yeah, right, we'll tell the story of the one good Russian.
Well, precisely. And then you get films, these sort of mainstream populist movies like Mission Impossible, Brian De Palma's film, which is basically the sort of complete takedown of Cold War iconography and
plus you get that awesome shot of John Voight crawling in slow-mo and his jowls wiggle every time.
That too. You end up having GoldenEye, the film in which Bond, proves that he has a place in a post-Cold War society, and then spent the next three movies struggling to find something to do.
Well, to be fair, though, I mean, GoldenEye, I remember the last time I watched it, holds up really well. I think it's true that your first Bond is your favorite Bond, but that was definitely the first one that I was old enough to really get into. I think I watched Dr. No before that and being like, when does he have cool gadgets?
Yeah, yeah. The Bond series definitely takes a little while to get there. But
I mean, I also remember being like 9 and renting The Pink Panther because I thought it was an animated movie.
Yeah. We had something of similar experience back when I was growing up. The point being that, yes, and then you get Gross Point Blank, the film in which most of Atomic Blonde steals its soundtrack from. But the key thing here being that that's a film that's reflecting on the 1980s in this very pop way, with people ruminating on their, you know, set at a high school reunion 10 years on from 1987. And it's basically about a contract killer in a world where, yeah, because of the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, the marketplace for hitmen has radically changed, and now it's like basically a capitalist free-for-all. It's a fun movie, but I mean, these are all very, you know, they have something to say about what this meant, what it meant for the Cold War to end, what it meant for that Berlin Wall to fall down. And suddenly we have this film that comes out in 2017. A solid, nearly 30 years on from when this took place. And the thing about this movie is, this is not made, the audience, I think, for the John Wick films and the audience that this film was made for skews young. They're not films made for an older audience who was around for the Cold War.
Yeah, and that's not to say that if you set a film in Berlin, it needs to have the same level of import and engagement that a Wim Wenders film does. You know,
most
certainly I don't
not.
Think that's an argument. You, I, or anyone who has opinions on film worth listening to is actually ever going to make. But there's something that just seems very cynical about how it's done here. And, I mean, I think the only way we can really express that is to get into the film. I don't have a lot to say about it, and I know it's got a lot of twists and turns as a narrative, but it feels like most of them are just deployed to have a plot intervention rather than it adding up. Like, we've talked about before how it's that swerve tendency where it's like, oh, we have a shocking twist or a shocking reversal just to catch the audience off guard, even though it doesn't hold up to narrative scrutiny or doesn't add anything to the film. But that being said, what is the narrative in the first place? We follow Lorraine Broughton, played by Ms. Theron, who's literally an icy, cool international operator for MI6, who has to go to Berlin on a very peculiar mission.
Well, and here's the thing. Before we even go down that road, there's two things we should note right off the bat. The actual opening of this film opens with footage of Ronald Reagan's iconic speech, in which he's asking for Mr. Gorbachev to tear down that wall. And, you know, in what is one of those moments where it's trying to play things sort of slick and fun and irreverent, we basically have it on screen. It details that, yes, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell down. And then right after Reagan makes his announcement, we see a can of spray paint, quote unquote, spray across the image and say, this is not that story. Okay. The thing that really sets me up about this right off the bat is that this doesn't feel like this is being irreverent, particularly once you see the film as a whole. This feels like basically a reassurance to the audience that you don't know history, don't worry, you don't need to in order to get this at all.
Well, here. They're not wrong, though.
Yeah.
It's just, okay. I mean, what do we even say about this film is a lot more simpler than it appears to be, and certainly than trying to follow it. Because, all right, what are the main aspects?
Okay, so yeah.
Louise is ordered by her superiors at MI6, including one played by Toby Jones, who's like Jared Harris to me, where, like, especially in films like Allied, when they're cast in a position of authority, I'm always like, it kind of feels like what Michael Caine has become, where it's like, you're an uncultured person's idea of a serious, dignified actor. Like, Jared Harris and Toby Jones, it's always like, I feel like you're the third choice for this role.
I'm a little bit more generous to both Harris and Jones. Michael Caine, I respect the man, but yeah, it's kind of hard to argue that. The thing about it is that the big thing we need to remember is that this is a framed narrative in the sense that when the film opens, Lorraine is actually, the mission's already over. She's back in the UK, and the first image we see of her, and I think in one of those moments that is actually kind of one of the points I was talking about in terms of the maybe something semi-progressive moment of this, we find her, she's in an ice bath right there. And when I say that, I mean literally it's a bathtub full of ice and water that she is sinking into.
Yeah,
and
that's why I made that ice joke.
Well,
not
yes.
Just a wordsmith for nothing, but like we see her body. Like, not only is she very muscular, but she is also covered in bruises.
Well, exactly. And I think this is one of those points where, again, when you talk about the idea of featuring nudity, particularly of a female actor on screen, that's a very loaded thing because of how it's been sort of misused. And again, it's sort of identified with the idea of being sexualized for the male gaze. In this instance, that's not what we get.
Yeah, there's a focus on the body in terms of its physicality, but not in an eroticized way.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm 99% sure you can put that at the feet of Theron more than anybody else in this instance. And again, she's the producer on this one, so I can guarantee she had the clout to sit there and say, we're not doing nudity in this movie, unless the following steps are going to be taken to do it.
Well, yeah, especially with her as, like, kind of the driving producer force in this film. But yeah, I mean, like, we get that, and we sort of see that is a visual, like, in addition to the shot itself, where it's all blue light and white surfaces, it's a very striking shot. And, like, regardless of anything I am about to say about the film, this is a visual tour de force. It is a beautifully shot film with beautiful lighting all throughout. Scenes are very cleverly constructed. There are some absolutely dazzling action sequences, but I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, here we see that, yes, we demarcate, this might be a bit of a different action movie, because you never see James Bond, like, with his ribs taped up, or, you know, having to ice his shoulder after a battle. Here we immediately see, in both narrative terms and in physical terms, like, the aftermath of what this job is like.
Exactly. And from this point, yes, we see her make her way to basically MI6 headquarters in order to be
debriefed. That may be the last clever thing this movie does.
Well, exactly, because at this point we get to, again, this film's, the first of its very catchy but questionable music choices, because we get the theme from Cat People by David Bowie, which was...
Yeah, and I'm like, I always love hearing Cat People in a movie, but not like this.
Well, this is the thing. This film song has now been used at least in three significant films. The film it was written for, yes, Paul Schrader's remake of Cat People from 82.
Weird, because I was just about to think about the other one, and I'm like, oh yeah. I guess Cat People counts too.
Exactly. And then there's, of course, Inglourious Basterds, Quentin Tarantino, which uses that song in magnificent fashion and a wonderfully anachronistic moment. And then we have it here where, okay, it's not necessarily an anachronism, but it also carries no real import to the film we're about to watch. I don't know why the song's going on other than, hey, wasn't this a cool song from the 1980s?
Okay, but it's even weirder than that. And I'm just going to skip ahead right now because I want to talk about this because I think it's one of the film's biggest curiosities. Because there are moments where there's that attention on the wall as the division and that focus on, especially like in that opening with all the shots of Berlin as a city. McAvoy has that monologue that we will get to about the city itself. Even using Bowie, you got to remember that like his sort of critical peak were the records he cut in Berlin as a city. And as an artist is very attached to that. There is so much of an attempt to show like, no, we are aware of Berlin and like we want to celebrate or visualize the city. And like, you know, even John Goodman's character. And that nice little monologue about looking over the wall and reflecting how many obstacles were there and how 6,000 people still escaped through it anyway. What would that be like? But ultimately, this film has nothing to say about the city. There is, it's gesturing towards making some kind of point or doing something with the idea of Berlin, and what is Berlin? What does it become when the wall comes down? What is that before? Because the film could take place in an any space.
Well, and that's exactly the problem because, yeah, the thing about Berlin is, yeah, it wants to emphasize it, but it doesn't establish what Berlin was prior to the wall falling down unless you know your history, in which case, yeah, I can guarantee as much as it pains to say me, much of the audience who's been born after the fall of the Berlin Wall probably doesn't know much about what the Cold War was or why Berlin itself was significant.
And well, yeah, because the issue is that as a narrative, I mean, twists and turns aside, Louise has to go in and achieve the first objective, which is retrieving a list of all known agents on both sides that somebody has somehow acquired. Why only one person would have that list or how they created it in the first place, spy movie trope, whatever. Yeah. The thing is, she has to go and retrieve that. And then later we find out that there's a secret hidden objective that we only learn like an hour into the movie. But basically it sets off a free-for-all and like a multi-headed spat between MI6, which is British intelligence, the CIA, the KGB, the Stasi, the East German Intelligence Service, and French military intelligence. And despite the fact that the climax is a panicked skirting of a man across the security border, like everybody just kind of goes wherever they want to and everybody just kind of does whatever the narrative requires of them. The sense of the city being divided and sectioned off is never really established.
Yeah, you get weird gestures to it because, and again, to quickly just go through the frame narrative, basically, Lorraine arrives at MI6 headquarters. She's being interrogated by her superior officer, Toby Jones, but also an American CIA agent who she doesn't seem to get along with and apparently has some experience with him during the mission in Berlin itself. That's the one played by John Goodman. And she starts basically recounting what happened and why the mission sort of went completely sideways. And yes, as it goes on, the major things is, yeah, get the list. Also, figure out who Satchel is. Satchel being the leak in British intelligence who seems to be giving information to the Soviets.
Yeah, if that sounds familiar, that's the exact same plot trope deployed in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. That shows off moral ambiguity and jurisdictional pissing contests a lot better than this movie does.
Well, precisely. And most of this is, again, taken directly in terms of its spine from the graphic novel here. What's mainly interjected is that instead of treating it like a serious spy story, they're going to inject a bucket load of action into it, which, hey, fine. But yeah, you then come back to these weird, curious choices to suddenly emphasize the Berlin Wall to a degree without ever developing into anything meaningful.
Yeah, it's arbitrary in when it picks and chooses to be like, this is a film about a place. Nope, this is a film where cool things happen.
Well, precisely, because, again, as we're getting into it, the major, Lorraine's major point of contact throughout this film is supposed to be David Percival, played by James McAvoy. And the thing
about... Yes, and the reason that they're connected is the whole reason the list goes missing is that an MI6 agent stationed in Berlin at the beginning of the film is gunned down in the street. The list is stolen from him by a KGB agent. And Percival was his former, I guess, like, partner. They were both high-ranking MI6s in Berlin.
Yeah, the big thing here is that, yes, Percival, yeah, is basically the guy on the ground for MI6. He's the one who's made the connections, worked his way into the city, and as the agents, or the superior officers note to Lorraine, he's basically just become one with the city in the sense that, yeah, he's adopted all the sort of tropes and countercultural elements of the western side of the Berlin Wall there. So,
yeah, because he has a shaved head and a furry coat, and he drinks whiskey in, like, remodeled warehouses.
Yeah, and what we note about him is, yes, in one of the few instances that suggests that, yes, crossing the Berlin Wall might be quote-unquote dangerous, sort of, is that, yes, we find him in the eastern section on the Soviet side of the Berlin Wall, where he's basically providing a group of youth with basically American rock and roll or British rock and roll and the finest booze that he can bring over, while also at the same time meeting with the guy who is his contact with who has memorized the list, played by Eddie Marsden.
Yes, Spyglass. His code name, who's, yeah, East German. He doesn't have much of a character. He's like the keymaster, you know, in The Matrix 2, where it's just, ultimately, you're the package.
Yeah, for the minute there, I thought you were going to say keymaster and we were going to Ghostbusters. I like where your head was at there. But the key point here being that, yes, what we see is, of course, there's a police raid at this environment, and yes, Percival has to sort of escape. When he gets to the wall, we get a weird sequence where, yeah, there are patrol officers there. He does something to distract them. He goes down a grate and then apparently just walks down a corridor to get through.
Yeah, now I never went to Berlin, even back when the wall was up. But for a film that again speaks to what this film is doing, where it's like, no, it is a dangerous, insurpassable barrier that literally bisects the world in symbolic and geographic terms. And yet, you know, it's very easy to just like walk into an apartment building and go out the back door and boom, now you're in West Germany.
Well, exactly. And that's really, it sort of signifies everything about this film in terms of how it gets Berlin wrong and sort of, again, doesn't do anything with it. Because, yeah, this should be a much bigger deal, his ability to cross over illegally across the border there.
Yeah, the same way that when Lorraine lands, before she even meets Percival, and as she points out, like, I was made from the second I landed. And like the same way that, you know, so we have the KGB guy, we have the Stasi guy, we have the French intelligence girl, and you know that she is from France because she rides a Vespa and takes photographs. And James McAvoy, but like these characters all just sort of meet whenever with zero consequence. So again, like, especially with the framing though, It leads to a real juxtaposition for me between like what we're being told and what we're being shown, where it's like, I was made from the second we landed and I realized like my cover was blown. Well, first off, you have like silver blonde hair and you certainly do not dress in a way that doesn't call attention to yourself. But also, yeah, you got made right away. Everyone knew who you were. That didn't necessarily complicate or jeopardize anything.
Well, and this is the thing, because what we see is, yeah, she gets there. She's picked up by two basically East German agents. But while she basically ends up getting it into a car crash so that she survives, they are heavily injured. And then Percival shows up to pick her up. And again, in sort of the way they treat Percival, it's like the idea is he's supposed to be the man on the ground in Berlin, but he's also a rapscallion and not necessarily trustworthy.
Yeah, he's a loose cannon. You don't know what this agent of chaos is up to. We like him, but do we trust him?
And more to the point, yeah, he shows up, picks her up, but he also decides, we're going to take one of their agents, throw him in the back of our trunk, go up to what I'm assuming is basically the embassy for the East German side on the Western side, unload the guy out of his trunk, and then start punching him in the middle of the day in front of it with no consequences here.
Yeah, I forgot that even happened because that's how impactful it is to the narrative.
Well, precisely. And from there, yeah, basically Lorraine Set decides, I'm going to my hotel, and she goes to her hotel, which, to be fair, is the most dazzling and well-lit set in the entire movie with this glorious
hotel.
Yeah,
they charge for a night, like, they can double it, and it would still be a bargain.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, the neon lighting grids up above, it's like, yeah, you clearly love 1980 cinema, David Leitch. Unfortunately, you missed all the point of it when you were doing so.
Well, yeah, like, I would have loved this film so much better if she lands in Berlin. You could do it like a one-room play, where it's just her in the hotel room, and the different intelligence operators keep coming, and she just has conversations and works them all over. And you would have saved so much money on it, the film would look better, and it would be more interesting. Because the fact is, characters just sort of go and visit each other whenever they want to anyway.
Well, precisely. And Lorraine's whole plan for how to figure things out doesn't make a lot of sense. She goes to visit a watchmaker who's apparently...
Till Schweiger, baby! Also in Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah. And apparently, yes, he's someone who... I guess help manufacture the watch that had the list in it, but she's looking for information from him about who to contact. So his elaborate thing is come back tomorrow night and he'll have it all put on the gears of the watch that she will then have to disassemble and sort of write down the grids.
Yeah, why don't you just tell them? There's subterfuge and then there's just being obtuse.
Well, it's the thing where it's like, okay, I get it. Maybe anybody's listening, but... still, I think there were simpler ways than making the watch. Give a piece of paper in an envelope and then burn it. There,
yeah.
You did it.
No, I mean, this is also a film, though, that, like, you gotta remember that with the framing, there are a number of reversals that happen, like, running constantly through the film. Or we'll see things and not really be twigged on why they're happening for quite some time. Like, for instance, we also see that Louise is generally wearing a wire.
Yeah.
Her name isn't Louise, is it?
It is not. It is Lorraine. Yes. We clearly care.
I hate this movie. So Lorraine is wearing a wire, and, you know, we don't even understand why until the end. And even though to say we understand why, I don't know. But like the same way that she gets her mission, and then we see her go off to find the list. But then, like 40 minutes into the film, we realize we cut back to that scene where she gets the mission. And then we realize, no, that wasn't the whole scene, because there's a secret second mission to find Satchel.
Yeah, and...
But, like, at the same time, it's one thing to reverse it. This is a film, though, that I feel like almost spoils its own narrative. Because, ultimately, like, not to spoil much, but it turns out that McAvoy's character basically ends up being one of the antagonists, or he certainly isn't an ally. And the thing is, though, like, from the moment that she ends up going, where is it when the police are called on her?
God, good question. I can't even remember where she is. The point.
No, she's going through the dead agent's apartment.
Oh, right.
And
yeah.
Then all of a sudden the cops show up. Now, she runs, but in her voiceover, the framing to the agent, she's like, I would have looked quicker had I known that Percival was going to call the cops. The problem is, okay, diegetically it makes sense because this is her reflecting on events. Yeah. But as it's said in the movie, the only like consequence of that is me then knowing, oh, so she can't trust Percival, or he is an antagonist now. So when it finally is shockingly revealed, when, in the form of him covertly shooting Spyglass The agent that he was trying to smuggle and protect, who, as we said, also has a photographic memory of the contents of the list, because, of course, like, it's not a shock. It was something I was fully, like, geared to expect. What was surprising about it is not the reveal, just the fact that he does it in the most, like, self-defeating and, like, why then get to this point at all kind of manner.
Well, and the thing is, even before he does that, the big thing that we should note here is that the person who stole the list in the first place, it turns out that the Soviet agents looking for him are ticked off because, as they point out to him, he's such a capitalist because he's made off with the list, hasn't shown up at his point of contact, and is basically going to sell it to the highest bidder, which leads to a scene where Percival meets up with the agent, and then proceeds to basically ice pick him right in the face so that he can make off with the watch that has the list in it while getting photographed by the French agent as well.
Of course, because, I mean, if you're so good at keeping a man with an eidetic memory that has seen a magic list of every spy agent, like, if you can do all those things, you are not going to look around you and make sure you're not being shadowed by a very attractive woman on a Vespa.
Well, precisely. And yeah, it just...
Oh, and that Stasi agent that you're looking at and talking to, you know, in an open space with absolutely zero blind spot, that guy who's a ruthless killer, and we see how cold-hearted he is as he beats up his underlings and murders innocent passerby, yeah, he's going to be looking directly in her field of view and not notice her too.
Yeah.
I guess this trainee French intelligence worker is just that good.
Well, okay, let's actually get into the character of...
Calling anybody in this film a character is being generous, and you know it.
I know it is, but the basic thing is, in the midst of this, somehow Lorraine finds time to start bar hopping to make contact or spy on people. It's never really clear, and I honestly don't care. But during one of these things, yes, she runs into, is it LaSalle, how you pronounce her name, or?
LaSalle, yeah.
Yeah. But the point of the matter is that while Lorraine is sort of flirting with this Stasi agent in order to basically get some information out of her, LaSalle shows up, there's some banter.
And like, with LaSalle, the whole thing is they, you know, I feel like they're trying to deploy the relationship as, it may not even be that they desire one another, but like, when you're in the life, you have to make do with what you have. But well, I don't think it comes off nearly that well in practice.
Well, and this is where the film makes a turn, because one of the traditions of particularly the Bond movies is the idea of sex and sexuality that goes along with being on spy missions. And of course, yeah.
And you know what other Bond trope reappears here? Watching your female love interest get murdered by a man.
Well, yeah, and this is... Okay, because, yes, what we end up seeing here is that, yes, Lorraine is bisexual in the sense that... Because what we didn't note earlier is that the agent who's murdered at the start, Lorraine lies about it because, yes, we see a quick flashback that, yes, she was in a relationship with him. Does it matter? Doesn't, because guess what? Never comes up again. Point of the matter is that, yes, after we end up getting a bit of flirting between the characters, and when they reunite, yes, this leads to a sort of on-screen love scene between them, which, again, is probably more tastefully shot than you would anticipate in the film.
So. Yeah, they're more focused on the lack of lighting to get the appropriate shadow that looks exactly the way they want it to than anything that those shadows are cast upon, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, it's basically there, and I can see the idea of where they're going with this and what they're trying to do, where it's like, yes, she's, you know, again, this idea of sexuality, you know, okay, in spy fiction being more ambiguous and fluid than is traditionally presented in the genre. I'm all completely fine with that, except, again, it would probably work better if I cared about these characters and what they were doing, and I just don't. And it leads to weird scenes such as LaSalle basically saying, there's something you should know about Percival, your friend Percival. And then she proceeds to whisper into Lorraine's ear after Lorraine cranks up the radio so that nobody can hear it. I can't even remember what she says, and I don't think it matters because we already know by this point that Percival is kind of a scumbag in this film.
And so it's like if, and this more or less coincides with us getting the secret mission that you need to find who Satchel is, and Satchel's name is on the list. And so, I mean, by that point, okay, the film is kind of clever again in the fact that diegetically turning up the radio means anyone who's trying to listen in, the audience included, is deprived of that information. But it's like, if the whole question is that there is a double agent, who realistically is it going to be? Because is the French late? Is LaSalle whispering, I'm Satchel? Is she whispering, Lorraine, you're Satchel? Is she going to be like, oh yeah, that guy who works for East German intelligence is also working for the Americans? No. So it's probably going to be Percival, or we know whatever is being said is a big secret that's crucial. So we already know, if nothing else, we know that there's going to be a twist coming.
Well, precisely. And the minute you end up introducing the concept of there being a traitor into this film, again, the audience is already programmed to start trying to piece together what passes for clues.
Yeah. Now, the thing with the LaSalle angle that maybe does make the film more interesting for it is that's one of those points where we can clearly see, though, a division beginning between what we're seeing go down in Berlin versus what Lorraine is recounting in the present.
Yeah.
Because, you know, to begin, it hues very closely. But around this point, like, you notice things start mismatching, but then it gets to the point where it is so, like, facepalming about it, where we see this love scene, and then it's like, did LaSalle tell you anything else? And then she flashes back to this whisper moment, but then we cut to the present of her looking sad and detached, staring at the wall for 30 seconds before saying, no, she didn't tell me anything. It's like the Wonder Years if you cut out the narration.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It is an interminably long shot in the context of where it appears.
And it's like, if everybody is a master spy, how are they all so bad at this?
Well, yes. And it's around this time where, apparently because I guess Lorraine isn't working fast enough, the British MI6 ends up asking the Americans in the form of John Goodman's CIA agent to show up and deliver a message to her at the Berlin Wall itself, which is where, yes, we get that nice little conversation about, you know, people still willing to strive to cross that border, even though they know all the danger that lies with it.
Yeah, the wall's a symbol of freedom, yeah, I guess.
Something, yeah. Point being that, yeah, she's basically told that, you know, don't screw this up and hurry up, get this thing wrapped up. Okay, so eventually, you know, she realizes that the real mission should be to get Spyglass across the Berlin Wall along with his family. And, you know, after meeting with her own contact on the ground, Merkel, played by Bill Skarsgård, who apparently hangs out on roofs and for reasons I honestly don't know.
And can dress like a cop and he looks like he's 12.
Yeah, I mean, I like Bill Skarsgård as an actor, but what he's doing here, I don't know.
He's all right. He's not offensive. But again, like, his character is meant to be mysterious, but instead it just comes off as a cipher, where it's like, this guy can be anywhere that he's needed because we literally have no grounding details about them.
Yeah, although I will say this, if the MCU is ever looking to cast Rick Jones in there, you could do worse. The key thing here,
that's going to make four people laugh very hard.
Yes, but in this instance, yes, what ends up happening is Percival and everybody, despite the fact that she doesn't quite trust him, cook up this plan where basically they're going to be, because what we should also note is that in the only sort of nod to try and explain what the Berlin Wall is, we keep coming back to television sets showing protesters and how everything's, you know, ramping up here in Berlin, even though every street,
the city's on the brink.
And then we go hang out at a bar where nothing's happening.
Then Thomas Wayne gets gunned down by a guy in a clown mask.
Sorry, people who haven't seen Joker. But the key
sorry to all the people who have.
Yeah, true. But the key thing here is what ends up happening from this point forward is that, yeah, they're basically going to use one of the protests on the street to sneak Spyglass across with Lorraine taking care of him And basically, Bill Skarsgård is Merkel and company taking care of his wife and daughter. Because, of course, he has a wife and daughter. And, of course, you know, the daughter's at that precocious age where it's supposed to tug at your heartstrings because, as we inevitably will find out, she loses daddy by the end of this. Again,
yeah,
it's like every cliche under the sun is being pulled out at this point.
Well, but I mean, the other spy cliche is the contingency plan upon contingency plan. Because while this whole climactic scene is well executed on a formal level, certainly as it develops, and certainly as it bleeds into the long take fight sequence, the problem is it strains plausibility, and again, because there's no sense of groundedness, or what exactly are the parameters of this universe? Because somehow Louise and company all know that snipers are covering the windows, and that they know that Spyglass is going to make a break for it using the parade as cover. I guess that they have him staked out in this crowd, to which then the entire crowd of people surrounding them synchronized black umbrellas coming out to block the field of vision. But somehow, in spite of that contingency, McAvoy is already aware enough that he uses that as a distraction to shoot Spyglass with a silenced pistol.
For reasons.
And as he says to, like, the Stasi guy, he says that, you know, he wants to keep the order in Berlin. I don't see how this helps with that. I don't see why Spyglass wouldn't tell Louise in the next, like, did it again, Lorraine, in the next 10 minutes. By the way, Percival shot me while you weren't looking. Like, so we end up getting this really awesome long take fight sequence going up and down stairways, going in and out of rooms. Like, it's a gritty and physical fight. It's like Daredevil, the staircase battle in that, mixed with the bathhouse fight from Eastern Promises, complete with eye stabbing, and it all ends with their car getting T-boned and Spyglass drowns, so everything was for nothing.
Well, yeah, and we should also know that, yeah, this is where most of the damage that we've seen to Lorraine's body at the start of the film comes from. And yeah, when you, again, full credit to Charlize Theron in this one, when you look at her face after all these fights, she is brutally messed up. There is no glamour to what they've done to her here. She's glamorous throughout the rest of the movie.
It's not a stylish form of fighting, however stylishly it's
shot.
It's filmed.
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about it, I think we talked about it with James, how, like, Red Belt films like Haywire, it's not about, like, jumping and throwing spinning kicks or slow-mo as much as it's that scrap, right? It's bodies hitting each other, and, like, you get that sense of kineticism to it. But what's that in service of, I guess?
Well, precisely. And ultimately, yeah, the big thing is that following the death of Spyglass, Lorraine starts organizing with Merkel and others to basically wrap this thing up and to deal with Percival and deal with
shut this thing down.
Effectively, yes. We were just missing Stephen Tobolowsky's cameo in this film. And using digital de-aging technology to make sure it's the same character and age-appropriate at that.
They should have de-aged John Goodman because he looks weird when he's thin.
Well, it's a different look. I will agree with you there. But the key thing being that as this is going down, she realizes that basically Percival is closing up shop. He's going to burn his facility to the ground. And I like the fact that his office is just like a tattered, you know, abandoned building more than anything else, so that he can just pour gasoline and light it on fire like nobody's business.
Yeah. But, well, it's Berlin. It's like, just book Eisenstein Neubauten, or however you say it, and they'll burn the building down at the end of their set.
Hey-o. But the key thing here is that as this is going on, Lorraine starts piecing together that Percival is probably going to go after everyone who's in on this, which includes, who could it be, Andrew?
LaSalle.
There we go.
Which, again, I mean, like, how does Louise piece that together? At this point, is she aware that Percival killed Spyglass?
I think she's put it together, but how she puts it together, I mean, maybe the film
maybe she put it together when LaSalle whispered whatever it was she whispered to her about how she shouldn't trust Percival.
It could be. It's hard to tell. And honestly, again, I don't
care. Oh no, the one thing we didn't want to happen.
Yeah, like, it's so hard to be vested in any of this when it's very clear that Nobody.
Because flashbacks within flashbacks and the curious framing, the problem is, for a film that tries to lay out as many twists and turns, that jumping not just between temporalities, but internal temporalities, makes this film very hard to put together on reflection.
Well, exactly. And honestly, it would be one thing if I cared enough to actually try and be invested, but at nearly two hours in length of spy cliche upon spy cliche, I was checked out basically by the 45 minute mark. Like, I don't care.
Yeah.
And it's,
I really lost enthusiasm and interest, like, probably by the 45 minute mark as well.
Yeah. Cause it's just that dull and that standard. And yeah, you pick up enough of the broad strokes to be able to keep following through to the end, but to actually care about what I'm watching, no, not at all. But
yeah, so to shut this thing down, though, it culminates in, Percival ends up killing LaSalle, and then Lorraine tracks down Percival and shoots him. And we'll get to that scene when we wrap up, I know. We'll put a pin in that for now.
Yeah.
And then we realize 3 days, like, that Lorraine, because she was wearing a wire, you know, she hands them proof that Percival was Satchel.
Well, sort of, because as we very quickly realize, all the proof that she's has is manufactured. The reason
So we get the proof, and like, it's a reveal that is immediately undercut by its own revealing.
Yeah, because basically, as she's telling the lie to her superior officer and Goodman CIA chief, she is pretty much, we see her pretty much, you know, assembling audio tapes of Percival talking to individuals, making it seem like he's the one who's selling everyone out. And the thing is,
oh man, this one's for you, Ross.
Yeah.
Because that just makes me think of, I asked you if Otto can live here.
Yeah.
Mom, can Otto come and live with us?
Yes! The weird places the show goes.
It's smoother than that. That's why she's a master spy, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like, I just feel like that's deployed as if it's supposed to be a big twist, which, A, even if that was the case, it's not, because we clearly know he's a bad operator. But we also realize that it's a lie the second that we're being told this.
And the thing is, in terms of its relationship to the graphic novel, this is the twist that does come from the graphic novel, where, yes, Lorraine is the double agent. She is the one who's been leaking information, and that a lot of it stems from, if I remember correctly, again, it's been 3 years and me far away from a Scottish airport to remember what had happened, but basically, yeah, it was something along the lines of her and her lover who was killed at the start were behind this. Point being that at this,
it makes Metal Gear look linear.
Yeah, the key thing here is that effectively, yes, basically, the British, or MI6, the chiefs and all that, look at everything, realize, well, I guess Percival did it, shut it down, nobody talk about this, nobody talk about Berlin, it's all past us, the list is lost out there, and it seems to be gone, let's just be happy that that's where things are, and move on.
And yeah, and we think that's how this is going to wrap up, but then we get, what is it, 3 days later?
Yeah, where this is invented for the film, and if we want to talk about twists upon twists where I want to start punching somebody, this is it, because
there's a lot of problems with this coda.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, Lorraine, very feminized in, finally wearing the red dress that showed up in Inglourious Basterds, though a different soundtrack this time. She ends up meeting with the Stasi dude in a hotel room, and it's strongly implied that they are either lovers or are very soon to be.
Well, it's that sort of traditional thing where basically there's the attempted seduction on his part where, yes, I must seduce you, why you give me the tape and everything. But of course, it turns out that, you know, she hands over the watch that supposedly has the material in it. And then, of course, he can't just let her go at this instance. And it turns out there's a whole bunch of agents in the room ready to take her down with him. And
good thing she put a gun in the ice bucket.
Yeah.
I'm not a handgun expert, but I'm pretty sure you got to keep your powder dry.
Well, I am going to say the following, that if there is a point to the motif of ice throughout this movie, I mean, Biondi, yes, it's a cold city. It
was
the
Cold War. Ice nurtures and it also destroys.
Sure, whatever.
Just like global warming will surely be the end of us all.
Yeah, let's go with that. Point of the matter here is that, yes, we get a massive shootout, which again, David Leitch, you know how to stage a shootout and fisticuffs without question. You nail it. It's actually not a badly executed scene. Where it goes problem is that we are chief Stasi agent at this point, who's on the ground. Lorraine's,
I love how we don't even care enough to mention what his name is or the actor who plays.
I really don't. But the the thing here is that basically Lorraine starts talking about how you think I was working for you, that I was feeding you stuff. And then, lo and behold, Charlize Theron drops the British accent she's been using the whole film to use an American accent at this point in time, removes her wig, and starts revealing that Satchel was basically there just to feed information, phony misinformation, to the Soviets to basically bugger up their works.
To get high-ranking intel, which, again, is the exact same plot of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yeah. So, she kills him. We then see her make her way to an airport, where it turns out that, yes, she just wants to go home and put all this double identity stuff behind her. Oh, and who just so happens to be on this plane with her? Why, none other.
Kurzfeld, the CIA dude.
Yeah, played by John Goodman, where, yeah, he's basically asking how she's doing. She's tired, wants to go home. And he questions the use of a profane word she used against him in the word there, and they all have a nice laugh. The film ends, and I give it them two middle fingers at that point in time. Because
is it when Percival is dying? Is that the Junger, or is it the Stasi guy that, as they lie dying at her feet, they like intimate, "Oh, Lorraine, I've read your file."
Well,
and like she looks visibly perturbed by that, and we're supposed to be shocked by that. And I think Percival says it because then it sets up the coda.
Yeah,
that, oh no, Lorraine is Satchel. But the problem is, like, that only means something if we know or are invested in any way in the characters. Because for all the film tries to present Lorraine as a strong, like, reserved, but smooth operator, for lack of a better term, she never is given a character. She's never really given a backstory, a personality beyond the job. So there's no point in being like, "I've read the file." Like, that means nothing, because we have no expectations to subvert. Furthermore, if she's this double agent operative, well, I guess triple agent, because she's actually working for CIA all along, somehow she duped MI6, duped the KGB and the Stasi, basically like gummed up allied and enemy intelligence networks, and she's the good guy?
Well, okay. I'm now disappointed in hindsight that the song Smooth Operator by Said is not featured on the soundtrack to this movie.
Sade,
my apologies. Sade, yes.
You're thinking of The Marquee, Dave.
Yes, but yeah, that's a killer song. I highly recommend everybody go out and listen to it at this point in time. Putting that aside, that's what really throws me about this movie. Because is this supposed to be a critique of American foreign policy and interference in terms of intelligence gathering? Because,
or is that a moment where it's rah-rah, show them how it's done, USA?
Well, that's the thing. It plays out like it's the former. And if that's the case, no, I have some serious questions about the ethics and of what you're doing and why you would have to implant an American agent in MI6 unless you're doing it because you don't trust your allies and there are other angles going on here. And if that's the case, nothing in this film, thematically, politically, at the level of subtext, anywhere, is that developed for the audience to latch into?
Well, yeah, because that final sequence, like, writ large, it's a sequence that's predicated on, "Bet you didn't see that coming," without ever being like, "And here's why everyone was doing that."
Yeah.
They don't do the second half.
Well,
they're just, "Ha! Didn't think she was a Yankee, did ya?"
Well, precisely. It's like, what's the point here? And I mean, again, correct me if I'm wrong, was Charlize Theron not a South African actress?
I believe, because Saturday Night Live, when she hosted, her and Tracy Morgan had a bit about how she was African-American. And they talked about smoking Newports.
Well, and the thing about it here is that, okay, I mean, it'd be one thing if the point was, okay, Charlize Theron is an American actor who's, quote-unquote, thinking is playing a British agent, only to turn out to be American. But it's not even that. There's not even a meta-text going on there, because, again, Charlize Theron is not American, she's not British. I mean, arguably, she's more British than she is American, given the connections between South Africa and Britain, but...
Like, it may seem like we're reading way too much into this, because I think the film is deeply stupid, but at the same time, like, you kind of are forced to ask that question, given the fact it is a Cold War narrative, and, like, the climax occurs. Like, she shoots Percival literally as the wall is being torn down.
Yeah.
And, like, so much of the final, like, 15 minutes is real news footage of the wall coming down and, like, you know, shots of people celebrating in the streets and that. And you feel like this is supposed to mean something, but it doesn't.
Well,
it's just decoration.
Well, absolutely. And I don't, like, I honestly don't understand why this script exists in the way it does. Because when you get right down to it, it's a movie that's too dumb to be an intelligent spy thriller. It's too...
It sounds like they took the source material and then decided, let's add some more gears and pulleys inside this machine so it'll ultimately have the same function as the source text, only vastly more complicated.
Well, vastly more complicated and with even less of, you know, even less of a point than the already pointless graphic novel. Because, and again, I'm not trying to sound mean towards the graphic novel, where it's dull, but it's harmless. And it's one of those things where I see what they're trying to do, you're failing, but I can at least respect that you were thinking you were doing something in that vein. And there's at least, if I remember correctly, when it comes to the Percival stuff in the graphic novel, I remember it as being the case that Percival is a scummy character, but he's also a character who ultimately is trying to effectively do his job on behalf of MI6. And for the United Kingdom. He's not a traitor. He's not a scumbag to the degree where he is an outright
villain.
But
he's not a traitor in this film, though, because even though he kills Spyglass, we realize he's not a double agent.
Well, no, you're absolutely right, but we are still meant to feel so much better about the fact that Charlize Theron's character, Lorraine, kills him, because, yeah, he wasn't a double agent, but he was a scumbag character who killed the French agent that I guess we cared about. And therefore, yes, this is righteous vengeance.
Well, yeah, like, LaSalle is introduced, and even though, I mean, there's something to be said for showing, like, two women that are self-aware and, you know, trying to make it in a man's world, kind of convenient that they both happen to become lovers, but, like, there could be something there if LaSalle had a character. She's not. She's introduced so we can get a bit of titillation, and then we can get a burning revenge motivator for that final scene between Percival and Lorraine. That's all she's there to do.
Yeah, and I mean, and again, this then builds up other weird questions, which is her former lover, the agent killed at the start of this movie, she never gets revenge for him, and it's hard to tell whether she even remembers he existed by about, like, the 20-minute mark in this film, because it's just dropped. Nobody knows or cares. And
does that mean that Percival then hired the KGB agent to kill his partner and steal the list?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't care. But I mean, I don't know. There's nothing in the film that makes it clear. And
well, maybe it does. It's just this film is also a cornucopia of Charlize Theron speaking in two different accents, a whole bunch of, like, Eastern European guys, and James McAvoy talking a mile a minute.
Well, yes, and I mean, here's the thing. I'm probably not as annoyed as you are, Andrew, because the thing about it is that, again, I checked out of the movie. It's hard for me to be super angry in the moment while it was happening, only because it's like, who cares? At the end of the day, I mean, this is a generic, you know, cliched spy film. At least it's, you know, the action sequences are half decently shot. There are more overtly objectionable films than this one.
Oh, yeah,
but,
definitely. Yeah. And I mean, I think there is a certain subsection of the audience. Like, this film was actually a more than modest success critically. And I mean, commercially, again, it did well enough to at least entertain thoughts of doing another one. And that's not always the case. And, I mean, it feels weird to come down on this film the way we're coming down on, because, I do feel like that gets us almost back to the territory of, you know, like, we're film critics. We hate what everybody else likes. But in this case, I think really what it speaks to is, and we've talked about before, like, the reason I dislike some Tarantino films and certain directors is, like, the problem is when you're trying to build films at the level of aesthetics first and foremost, and you want to take influences from real-world iconography, from classic movies in a similar genre, from history, from people's lived experiences. If you're just pulling visual images out of that, though, and disconnecting that from its political, historical, social context, like, there's a point after which I think that can become disruptive. Or destructive, rather. Like, I remember seeing Sin City in theaters when I was 20, and I remember Clive Owen falling in the tar pit and the white outline and his red shoes and thinking, that is the coolest looking thing I've ever seen. And now I'm a bit older, and I don't give Frank Miller the same pass that I used to for having cool looking images, right? And, like, this is a film where it's a whole bunch of cool looking stuff and lip service to history, but it doesn't know what it ultimately has to say about it. It's just like it's borrowing Cold War aesthetics because it thinks it looks cool while glossing over everything that actually is summarized in those very powerful images.
Well, and that gets us right back to the question, though, of who the hell was the audience for this film? Because if you're somebody who knows anything about spy fiction in film or literature, if you are somebody who knows the history of the Cold War, if you know the history of Berlin, all this film is going to pretty much do is tick you off. Because, again, it does, I mean, it references all these things, but it doesn't understand a lick about them. And again, why watch this movie when you have a bunch of others? But if you are...
Yeah, they could have called this Moving Parts, the movie.
Yeah, but if you're a younger audience who... don't take this wrong. This is not intended to say young audiences don't know history. I'm just generalizing in the sense that, again, as with any generation that comes up afterwards, it happened before you were born. It might seem like much older history than it actually is. But the point is...
Yeah, but if the aim is to make a spy film for people that don't really like spy films or think that other spy films are too boring, I think there's certainly kind of an attitude to do that with this film. But, like, why then set it at such a flashpoint for international intelligence services?
Well, absolutely. Why set it historically at all? Why not do this as a contemporary piece anywhere in the world? Like, and I can't believe I'm saying this.
Yeah, there are plenty of European cities and plenty of points in time you could have set this film in. You happened to do it right as the wall was coming down, so it's like, why?
Well, yeah, I mean, hell, even...
And I think, honestly, it's because the interest that David Leitch and Theron and crew all have is because that will lead to some amazing cinematography and some amazing set design. And they're right.
Yeah.
But I guess the question is, what's the point where a film... where it stops being okay for a film to be a thrill ride or a feast for the eyes? You know, like, Michael Bay films are very high gloss in that, and I think we all agree they're largely pretty stupid. But, I mean, they seem pretty harmless.
We'll debate that one, but yeah.
Okay, your mileage may vary. Yeah. But I guess it's like a sliding scale, where it's like, yeah, that was a fun popcorn film, versus this is a film that's repurposing real history in ways that maybe not necessarily lead to good things.
Well, and I think when it comes right down to it is that the problem isn't necessarily that it's a vapid action movie. Like, the problem ultimately comes down to
I don't think it makes me as angry as something like Marie Antoinette, where it's like, oh, cool. The whole reason this character speaks to you, Ms. Coppola, is because you really, really liked the way she dressed.
Well, at least in the case of Marie Antoinette, I see what maybe Sofia Coppola is doing. I don't agree with it, and I don't like it, but I can at least respect...
I see exactly what she's doing, and that's why I hate that film.
Yes, but I can at least sit there and say, okay, I see what your end to this was. I think it doesn't lead to a good movie, but I can at least say it. In the case of this one, you've made...
Yeah, too bad your dad forbade you from making thrill ride cinema.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, meanwhile, there's Francis Ford Coppola funding a pedophile to go off and make some horror movies, but that's another story for another time. The point of the matter here is that when you get...
I don't think I know that story, but it sounds more interesting than Atomic Blonde.
Jeepers Creepers, folks. Jeepers Creepers.
Oh, yeah! That pedophile.
Yeah. The point of the matter here is that when you get right down to it, it's like, it's a film that frustrates me because, and maybe it is the fact that, yeah, I am somebody who knows the history of these things. I know what it could be. And it's not like I'm against fun pulp Cold War films. We loved The Hunt for Red October for precisely that reason. It is a smart film with its subject matter. Not a brilliant movie, not a deep movie, but it's clever, it's fun, and it plays with, you know, the meaning of the Cold War in a way that suggests that at least it's made by people who at least understood what they're dealing with. I just get the sense that everybody involved in this movie looked at the 1980s and said, boy, I really wish we could make a movie that looked like that. I wish we could make a
espionage
film.
Espionage chic, right?
Yeah.
It's like people who want to dress like the Black Panthers while having no interest in the ideology underpinning the movement.
Well, precisely. Or, you know, I want a film that has that particular 1980s soundtrack. Again, I get it. Setting in the 1980s is probably an easy way to have an excuse to have a 1980s soundtrack. Then again, Guardians of the Galaxy proved you don't have to set it in the 1980s for that, and you can create context within your film to have these iconic pop songs there that actually register in a meaningful, at least emotional or affective way than it does this. So,
I mean, looking back to Tarantino, and the reason I keep coming back to him is, you know, personally, like, I do have a lot of difficulty with him because his films do often run into that problem of, like, okay, you're shooting films and telling these stories because you think it's cool or because you're influenced by a set of images, but sometimes it works because, like, Inglourious Basterds and the play of history, like, that's done in a way that causes the viewer to reflect on what we actually expect and assume of historical narratives. And, like, it ends up being, I think, fairly clever. Whereas Django Unchained, this sort of wish fulfillment slave revenge fantasy gets so disconnected from quote unquote reality that, like, there's something that just feels grotesque about watching it.
And it's a complicated thing. I know I'm more forgiving of Django than some.
Not saying that this film is necessarily grotesque, but it's like, why even subject yourself to that question if you don't have to, and if you are not at all interested in making a necessarily, like, politically insightful film?
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, when you get right down to it, you know, say what you will, but Triple X is probably a more worthwhile spy film in the sense that, as dumb as it is, and believe me, folks, Triple X is a dumb movie.
I have not seen that movie, but weirdly enough, I was thinking about it as I was driving into my building's parking lot yesterday. I remember in a trailer that Vin Diesel uses, like, a aluminum serving tray to, like, do a rail grind down some stairs.
Well, there's things, like, I mean, it's a film that at least knows what its audience is. And putting aside the fact that it's made by scumbag Rob Cohen, I mean, it's a film in which, yes, at the end of the day, I mean, it's a film about a hip circa late 20 or mid 2000s era.
I can do all kinds of extreme sports.
Well, they do extreme sports, and it's like, yo, we need a hipper, cooler agent for the, you know, this generation. And it very knowingly is basically riffing on, you know, it opens up with a clear James Bond stand-in finding himself out of place at, like, I can't remember if it's like a Rammstein concert or something, where it's like, this is stupid, but at the very least, you know what? I get what you're doing, and you know what? You're dealing with pop culture and pop understanding of things. It's not connected to reality at all.
Like, this film wants to have the style of, like, that cartoony approach, but its narrative is way too self-serious and, like, po-faced to really pull that off. If they made a big cartoony spy movie in the vein of Triple X that was shot the way this film is, great.
Yeah.
I am all for that. But I think this is a film that doesn't know whether it wants to be a story or a set of images, and it vacillates between the two in a very unsatisfying way.
Well, no, absolutely. And at the end of the day, it's a film where, yeah, it feels like it's custom made to annoy someone like me and someone like you, Andrew, and your mileage will probably vary depending upon how invested in the Cold War and how deep your knowledge of it is. And that, do not take that as a slam if you're not invested in it. That's not my point. It's just that...
Well, I think it's more just a referendum on formalism. You know, the idea, like, formalism traditionally just means, like, putting your attention to the mise-en-scene, the cinematography, the look of the film above any narrative register. You know, formalism certainly has its place. Certainly art cinema owes heavily to formalism. Avant-garde cinema is a kind of formalism. You know, there's a time and a place for that. But, I mean, like, this is... Yeah. If you are the kind of viewer that can just take in the images and just follow along with the twists and turns as they happen, sort of like the process of viewing, rather than like not thinking analytically, but if you're the type of viewer that wants your film to add up to something or to make sense and not just be that thrill ride, then this probably isn't the film for you.
Absolutely. So this concludes Andrew and Dave Sound Like Grumpy Old Men. And with that, I guess we should probably turn to the hits and pits such as they are for this film. So Andrew, I guess to get us started here, what is your first hit for Atomic Blonde, if any?
I would probably give it to the cinematography by Jonathan Sela, who had worked on Deadpool 2 and Midnight Meat Train, so the man loves a blue filter. But, I mean, overall the film does have a very polished look, it's edited well, there's some very clever scene transitions. It's the only film I've seen other than Speed Racer where they do that edit where the background will slide out of frame and be replaced with the subsequent one, and the foreground will a few seconds later. It's not as pronounced. I think it only happens once here. But, like, especially the climactic fight scene, it's like a tour de force moment. It is very well constructed, very well shot. And I think the part I appreciate most is it's like in Children of Men, you know, it's a long take that you only recognize it's a long take, like, when you're well into it. And if you can do something that formally complex while making it seem invisible, that takes a certain amount of skill. I mean, this film does have its stumbling blocks, but looks, that's the area that everyone cared about, and they pull it off in spades here.
Absolutely. For me, I'm going to give my first one to Tyler Bates, who... Yeah, yeah, his score, you know, Bates is one of those composers I think that's kind of underrated. He's sort of just below some of the big cats working today. But,
well, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's sort of like composer slash compiler, right?
To some degree, yeah. And I mean, certainly we'll get to the song selection of this film at another point here momentarily. But in terms of the score itself, when it's sort of trying to recreate that sort of synth vibe without using actual tracks from the 1980s, Bates really sort of nails it. And it's something that he's very, very good at. I think he is a really, really underrated composer. And again, this is not dissimilar from the work he's turned in the Guardians of the Galaxy films, for those who've seen that. And for those who've seen, or again, another film that plays with history in a much smarter way, Zack Snyder's adaptation of Watchmen, which, yeah, that's a, you know, I will go to bat for that Zack Snyder film, if no other, in this instance.
And also featured Nina's 99 is in Luftballon. I guess he really likes that song.
Well, we'll get to the music track selections here, because I'm not sure whether Bates is the one to blame for this, but... We're getting there. We'll get it. What about you, Andrew?
Now I'm excited.
Yeah. What's your...
I mean, the soundtrack's good. I think it has that sort of... It's a very modern kind of action movie score. It feels like maybe Hannah, the Chemical Brothers score for that, is like the high watermark. But it's sort of in that same vein where there is something like not just rhythmic, but almost pulsing to it. So it gives a sense of momentum and kineticism to the images very nicely.
Absolutely. But with that, what would be your second pick for or hit for this one, Andrew?
Probably Charlize Theron. I mean, she's our point of identification. I don't think Lorraine has much of a character, but you know, she's convincing in her role, and you know, she also looks good when she's fighting, and you know, wherever they threw in the stunt actors, it's pretty seamless, if they were even relied on much at all. I don't know. I mean, she's our through line. We like the way this movie looks, and we like it how it sounds. I think the only reason that we're not irked more by it is the fact that we get a pretty good performance out of a pretty thin script here.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, they didn't get the, what was her name? Chun-Li, Rise Legend of Chun-Li.
Oh, Kristen Keurig.
That's the one. Yeah. Imagine if Atomic Blonde starred Kristen Keurig.
I can sit there and say easily that the Universal executives say, we're going to pass, and there would not be a film
at all. Okay, see, and that's why Charlize Theron is my second hit. What about you?
I'm going to go with a slightly ironic hit for this one, because I know you're going to disagree with me on this one, Andrew, but...
Oh my god, if you say it, Dave, I am canceling this show.
I enjoy James McAvoy's ridiculous Berlin speech at the end. It's terrible.
No.
It is terrible.
No.
But it is hilariously funny to watch because it has no place to do with this movie. And McAvoy clearly by this point in time is just, nope, I am going to choose scenery and just you try and stop me. And yeah, I swear to God, the minute you allow him to have a close up where he gets to speak directly to a camera, you cannot stop
him. Yeah, that's kind of his thing. Yeah. It's just like, what bothers me the most about is that the way it is written, it is clearly written to be a big, rousing monologue.
Absolutely.
Watch that scene from this movie and you will know exactly what I mean.
Well, it is, but I mean, even as you get to the end of it, it's like, I effing love Berlin is just, what does this have to say to anything? Not a bloody thing.
Yeah,
but
that means nothing because the film doesn't establish what Berlin even is. It doesn't give Percival a character. He says that, and that has zero connection to anything. And yet, this is supposed to be his big Rorschach spitting in the eye of the devil kind of moment.
Yeah,
it's like we go from "Do it," you know, to "Oh, I love Berlin" without ever explicating why. It's just, it's that trite, like, yeah, it's hectic, it's a nightmare, you can't trust anybody, there's cops everywhere, there's soldiers everywhere else, but you know what, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
What?
Only with him wearing a stupid coat and, you know, somehow being more over the top.
But again, you gotta give credit to McAvoy. He took two looks at that, said, I'm gonna wear that coat, I'm gonna have that haircut, and I'm gonna commit to the absurdity of what I'm doing here. And...
okay, I give a second, a third hit to James McAvoy's coat.
Yeah, so...
it does look very warm.
But with that, we should turn to the pits here. And Andrew, I'm sure you've thought of something that we haven't said yet.
My first pit is also James McAvoy's coat, because for his murder, climate change is real. My first real pit, I would say, is... I would probably say the script.
Yeah.
Which, who was that? Oh, yes, no, not Anthony Johnson.
Kurt Johnstadt.
Kurt Johnstadt. Yes. Okay, different John derivation. Only because, like, this is textbook making your film much more complicated than it needs to be for no actual benefit. It's written in a way where things are said as if they're important and meaningful. There's a lot of moments where it's almost like, oh, look at how cute you're trying to be. Like, there's a lot of moments where you see exactly what they're trying to do. And it's not that you're confused or it's going over your head. You just see it and it's not working. And a lot of that stems from, I think, how the story of this film is structured and that odd framing and the temporal jumping. All of that comes from a script. Usually, I think when there's a problem with a film, it can be traced back to the script. And I think in this case, like, that is very clear.
Oh, absolutely. Now, the question to which degree Johnstadt was just following orders from the higher ups above on him on this one, it's hard to say, but certainly he didn't salvage it.
What is it with Berlin and the phrase just following orders?
Ooh, okay. Wasn't going there, but yeah. So we went that far. For my first pit for this one. And it's going to sound really weird coming from me, Mr. 80s himself, but
okay.
The selection of songs on the soundtrack. And let me be clear, it's not...
Don't knock Susie and the Banshees, because I am going to cancel this show for real.
Okay, no, follow me on. The problem is not the songs themselves. I love every single track that is in this movie. They're great songs. Again, this is custom made to appeal to a person like me. The problem is that they are all the most obvious choices and the most radio friendly played ones for the most part throughout this one. It's not like, again, I joked that this half the soundtrack was borrowed from Gross Point Blank, but it's true. The difference being that when Gross Point Blank did it, again, that's a film about a high school reunion. Of course they play the hits.
Yeah, so of course they'd be playing that all through the night.
Exactly. Whereas this film, it's like, okay, I mean, I love 99 Luftballons, but again, I get it. This is Berlin. It's a German song that became popular in North America. Of course, you're going to play the German version of it here. But of course, it's about, you know, the dangers of warfare and the absurdity of escalation.
Though apparently, if you directly translate the German lyrics, apparently, like, the idea of East-West separation is much more apparent. I don't know if that's true because I don't speak German well enough to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But if that is the case, it's kind of fitting that, well, again, you have a movie about Berlin featuring a song that people associate with Germany, but no one really quite understands what it's actually saying.
Well, absolutely. So, but I mean...
It's like a Matryoshka doll of ignorance.
Well, pretty much. And I mean, it's the same thing with a lot of the other tracks here. Like, Falco on the soundtrack. Again, I love Falco. I mean, again, another German artist.
No, you don't, David. No one loves Falco.
Vienna Calling is an amazing song, and so is Rock Me Amadeus. So take that.
Okay, the only Falco I need is Covering My Wing in Star Fox 64.
Oh, boy. At any rate,
also for the Super Nintendo.
But the point is, I mean, it's like, again, if you're going to do a 1980s soundtrack for a film, can we please retire the obvious choices? Let's start digging deeper and finding the stuff that didn't get as much radio play or was only a modest hit at the time. There is plenty of stuff out there. Cat People does not need another use on a feature film anymore. It's been done. Leave it be.
Wouldn't it be weird if we found out that, like, Till Schweiger owned the rights to that song? And then we slowly pieced together over time that every time he's cast in a movie, like, you know, we rent an old copy of Driven, and then suddenly it's like, oh yeah, they did play Theme from Cat People during the race.
There was a really weird story there, and I actually want to see that on screen, but yeah.
Oh man, Stallone turns into a car and falls in love with John Hurt.
Oh boy. but yeah, so, I mean, on the level of the soundtrack, I do have issues with the selection only in the sense that it's a fairly lazy selection all around. There's so much more you could have done. And as somebody was pointing out to me, most of the selections on this track are from the early 1980s, not by 89. I'm not saying that that's an issue.
It's East Germany. They're a couple years behind.
Yeah, fair point. But yeah, that's my first...
They were still listening to 22 and a half RPM records.
Yeah. But the key thing here being that, yes...
Thanks for no selling that.
My apologies. The point being here that, yeah, that's my first pit. What about you, Andrew? What would be your second pit for this one?
I don't care enough.
Yeah.
We've talked about this film long enough. I am done with... Okay, my second pit. What does Atomic Blonde mean?
Oh.
It's not her code name. It's not a hair color. It's nothing.
Yeah.
There is nothing atomic about this film.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
There's no nuclear device at the heart of the plot. There's no radiation secrets. There's no, oh, we're trying to leak this technology to North Korea. No, it's there because it sounds cool and it sounds hip and it sounds like something that a spy movie should be called. And that's the only reason it's called that.
You know what does actually feature, you know, a nuclear device, seemingly a nuclear device and punk aesthetic?
Human Highway?
Repo Man. A much better 1980s movie that you can also go out and watch, folks. So.
Yeah. See, I was going to guess Kiss Me Deadly until you said punk aesthetics. I don't know, man. Cloris Leachman was totally punk.
Anyways, on that note, yeah, we should wrap this thing up. So, Andrew, where are we heading after this surprisingly angry episode of Film Strips.
Okay, well, considering I didn't think I'd have anything to say, and we still got some mileage out of that, I would say our mission is accomplished, maybe better than David Leitch's own was. So, we are going to go to a little bit lighter territory. None of that faux self-seriousness. But you know what we did like about this movie? The soundtrack. We tend to like awesome soundtracks. That's not our point of connection, though, because instead we're going to be following Charlize Theron to a film with a much better overall vibe and a pretty awesome soundtrack. That's right, we're looking at Tom Hanks' directorial debut, 1996's That Thing You Do.
Oh.
Which, funny enough, showed up on our show musically without even planning it. Yeah. Yes, the sort of alternate retelling of your favorite rock band, The Rise and Fall of Teeny Boppers, with a cast including Tom Hanks, Giovanni Ribisi, Jonathan Shayek, Tom Everett Scott, Steve Zahn, anybody else?
Charlize Theron?
Well, yeah, okay, yes, Charlize Theron, and whoever played TB Player.
Yes.
I haven't seen this film since I was probably about 14 years old, and I'm really pumped to go back.
Absolutely. So if you want to see a film full of 90s that guys, stay tuned for next week.
Yes, and if you want to listen to an episode where me and Dave make much more pleasant jokes and talk about things we liked about a film, be sure to stay tuned. Dave, where's the best place for people to find us each and every week?
A very angry Francis Ford Coppola can reach me at 24Panels. I don't care. I'm still going to remind people that, yeah, you helped make those Jeepers Creepers films happen, folks. So, yeah, screw you, Ford Coppola.
Yeah, and he wasn't looking at them peepers.
Oh, my God. Andrew, where can people reach
Wait,
you?
Wait, maybe Victor Silva was arrested for peeping-related crimes. Okay, moving on. You can find me on Twitter at FilmStripper. You can also email me and Dave. Whatever commentary that you have to offer at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And as always, you can find us each and every week on iTunes and whatever other podcasting service you use. It's also a place where you can rate and review us. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured list and get new eyes and ears onto the show. Above all else, it's a place where you can leave your review. Let us know. How are we doing? Because every week, David and I just try to bring you the kind of show that you want to listen to. And every week other than this one, we usually hit that mark.
Yeah, absolutely. But until then, Andrew, do you have any parting words for our listeners?
Why, yes, David. Yes, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Granted, it could be worse. Monotony could show you Atomic Blonde.
Or it could cast you in the next Jeepers Creepers movie.
She makes me crazy, doesn't have a vicious bone in her body, ain't it tasteful? She says she hates me, and later on she says she's sorry. Thinking of these things, holding him down, and pulling off his wings. Thinking of these things, holding him down, and pulling off his wings, blonde and blue, troubled and misused, living without you, my heart is yours, when nothing lasts forever. We'll always be together. Nothing lasts forever. My heart is yours.